Savannah County Board of Supervisors meeting on September 18th, 2024. We'll have the pledge allegiance and all the signs.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Hey, do you have any?
Do we have any adoptions to the agenda?
One.
I think we had one that we have not had a change to in the last few years.
One, I would like to add under new business, rural cluster subdivisions, just to give the board just kind of a, so all the boards familiar with where the, kind of, you know, the requirements. And also, you know, we just had a couple rural cluster subdivisions that went before the planning commission, and plus it was discussed during the board's retreat site as well.
And if that's. Any motion? So Brian made the motion, seconded by Mr. Sheridan, all in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye, 5-0. All right, county administrator's report?
Yep, Mr. Chair, members of the board, have a few things to report. A few new employees to report. That started with county. So Christian Negron started with as a communications officer for E911. He started September 3rd. Magruder, who goes by MJ Fick, started with emergency services, and EMT ALS provider started September 10th. Andrew Vaughn, also with Emergency Services Department and EMT BLS, started September 10th. Nawal Rahmani started with the Department of Emergency Services as an EMT BLS, started September 10th. And then Chris Leggett, also with the Department of Emergency Services as an EMT BLS, started September 10th. As a reminder, the Fluvanna Family Fall Festival will be held at Pleasant Grove Park Saturday, September 28th, from noon to 5 p.m. Free admission with a donation of a non-perishable food item or $2 cash and free for kids. And basically, this kind of stemmed from a group from the FLDP program, and really it's, and there's a couple county employees that were part of the group, and really this is kind of meant to be almost a, we'll call it a small old farm day almost, as a one-day event. So again, crafts, food and beer garden, music, so history and agricultural events too. So hope to see people come out for that event. And then just some upcoming meetings. October 2nd, we have a 5 p.m. regular meeting here. October 16th, we have a 6 p.m. regular meeting in the courthouse. And then November 6th, we have a 5 p.m. regular meeting in the courthouse. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, I have one question. You had four new BLS providers.
Yep.
And it seems like on a quite regular basis, we have new BLS providers. What's the turnover rate in that department?
That's a good question, and I could try and pull that information for you. I know I talked to the chair. We were going to do, I was looking at potentially the first meeting in November, kind of doing a state of EMS and you know, EMS for the county, and kind of, you know, where we've been. You know, we've had the department up and running for a year now. I don't think a lot of it is necessarily people leaving. Sometimes it's maybe people that are not meeting the standards. If we have new rehires, no, it doesn't mean that there's some that aren't meeting. But I don't have the specific statistics, but I can get that for you.
That all forms part of it. So if there's turnover, you got to ask yourself if you have problems. If you are having to weed out bad apples, you need to ask yourself: is our recruitment process as robust as it should be?
Yeah.
We really need to minimize that, and also the amount of vacant positions we have. Are we making headway on that?
On some of them we are, yeah. And some of them it's just we're not getting any applicants for some of the positions. It's just amazing how, and let me say this, some of the positions that we are getting applicants for, like being remotely qualified is not even there. We talk about it all the time. It is such a weak, strange labor market right now. I mean, I think of way back when we used to get, for certain positions, just 30, 40 applicants. And now, granted, they're all not, you know, necessarily qualified, but you'd at least get probably five that look good on paper out of that batch, five, maybe 10, and we're not even seeing remotely close to that nowadays.
Could some of that be in part due to the low unemployment rate, so the amount of people looking is lower, and then we need to ask ourselves, how do we stack up against neighboring localities and other people that are looking for these same types, and maybe we need to make an adjustment?
Yeah, you know, I will tell you what, if you go to, like, for instance, if you go to, like, Vaco's site, or you go to, like, I'll just use another one, like VGFOA, and you look at, like, open jobs that are out there, there are a lot of open jobs, more than you used to see previously. So it's the environment that we're in. So.
I had a similar question, because I noticed it seems like each
board meeting
almost we're having
at least one.
Then we're getting them filled.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll also mention that Fort Kenyon Festival Saturday I went to, really a nice event, and I saw Mike sharing there, and it should be a great base for building the future. I think it's going to grow.
Yeah, very good event. Appreciate LRD for organizing that again for the second year. I know they had a good working relationship. We moved down to the Academy field this year where Pegasus Lands is where they had it. So it was a lot more space, more spread out, just a great event, great weather again. So thanks to all those who were involved with that. And I don't know how I missed you guys there, but.
I was trying to
talk to Danny for about 20 minutes.
Danny talked for over 20 minutes?
No, with me, he didn't talk very much.
You and Danny talked? You and Danny had a long conversation? I couldn't. I figured y'all's minimum would be 15.
All right, we will now open our first round of public comments. Anybody wishing to address the board, please come to the podium, state your name and address, and remember to keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic when directed to the board. Anybody wishing to address the board at this time? Seeing none, we'll close the first round of public comment. All right, we'll move on to presentations. Item A, Fluvanna County Public Schools Funding Appropriation Method. Eric Dahl, County Administrator, and Dr. Peter Gretz, SCS Superintendent.
So, Dr. Gretz, if you want to come up to
sure.
the mic, and what I can do, I can go through the presentation. If there's things that you want to address along the way, or if the board has questions, again, you know, some of this is just kind of based upon state code. Some of it, we got some information from VACO, so I'll just kind of go through it, and whatever questions the board has, we can stop and as we go. So just, you know, basically funding of public schools. So the Virginia Constitution requires that each county provide a minimum revenue sufficient to comply with the state standards of quality, which is also known as the required local effort. Each locality share is determined by basic aid formula and the local composite index. And the school board must prepare, approve, and submit its proposed budget by April 1 or at least 3 months prior. Again, the school board usually brings forward their budget usually around in February time frame, so usually well in advance of that April 1st time frame. And then again, the board of supervisors is under no obligation to accept the school budget, but they must fund at least the minimum required by SOQs. And then while the board of supervisors may reduce or increase the estimate submitted by the school board, and make appropriations or impose a levy for school purposes, the Board of Supervisors cannot make changes in individual line items in the school budget. And the Board of Supervisors, however, may make changes in the total dollar amount, or if the budget was approved by a major category, as long as it's not below the SOQs. So then again, just looking at funding in total, so again, you know, currently, I'll touch on that later, again, there's two ways to fund the schools, either funding in total, again, you know, $1 amount that covers all the school division operations, or funding by major classification category. And some of them are below here, but I'll kind of go through them a little bit more as we go on. But those are the two basic funding methodologies. So a little bit from state code. So the underlying piece is kind of to bring your attention on. So this is under the Code of Virginia for appropriating funds to school boards and management of funds. Basically, if funds are appropriated to the school board by major classification as provided in section 22.1-94, no funds shall be expended by the school board except in accordance with such classification without consent of the governing body appropriating those funds. And then it just talks about, you know, that no school board shall expend or contract to expend in any fiscal year in excess of what was appropriated to them. In addition, appropriations by the county, the amount appropriated by the governing body for public schools shall relate to its total only or such major classifications prescribed by the Board of Education pursuant to section 22.1-115. And 22.1-115 talks about the system of accounting and really kind of talks about the board shall prescribe the following major classifications for expenditures of school funds. And it goes down to instruction. Number one is instruction. Number two is administration, attendance, and health. Number three is pupil transportation. Number four is operation and maintenance. Number five is school food services and other non-instructional operations. Six is facilities. Seven is debt and fund transfers. Eight is technology, and nine is contingency reserves. And then per state code, and I'm not going to read all these, but these are kind of, these will be in the presentation, and the presentation will be online. Under each one of these classification categories, it kind of gives a little, just a little verbiage of kind of what falls underneath there. And, you know, mostly from the title, I think it's mostly self-explanatory for what falls under from instruction, you know, anything related to interactions between students, aides, classroom assistants, and teachers, you know, with a focus on instruction, administration, attendance, and health. Activities concerned with school board services, executive administration, information services, personnel services, pupil transportation, again, you know, deals with transporting students, operation and maintenance, activities concerned with keeping the physical plant open, comfortable, safe for use, grounds and buildings. School food services, again, deals with, you know, providing meals, lunches, and snacks. Facilities, you know, activities concerned with acquiring land, buildings, remodeling buildings, constructing buildings, debt service and fund transfers, you know, obviously is it specific to debt service, if there was any debt service that was specific to the schools themselves. Currently, the schools don't pay any debt service specifically out of their operational budget. Actually, when I started here back in 2011, there was some trailing debt service payments that the schools specifically were paying. I don't know how that came about, but there was a small piece that they were paying. Technology, again, you know, anything technology related, and then contingency reserves. So currently the county funds the school board appropriations based upon a total only methodology, and that's been the methodology that the county's funded the schools as long as I've been here, probably for quite some time, is probably going way past probably that standpoint as well. Again, once the total only appropriation is set as part of the annual adopted budget resolution, the school board maintains control of expenditure classification within its budget, and then the school board uses the below major classifications to report expenditures internally and as part of the annual budget. So again, they use instruction, administration, attendance, health, pupil transportation, operation maintenance, technology, and school food services. School for food services is passed through. The county doesn't fund school food services. That's basically a self-sustaining enterprise fund. So the funds collected from, you know, individuals for school food services pays the expenditures for that. And then, again, choosing how to fund the categories for the schools. So this information was provided by VACO. So in March 2021, VACO surveyed member counties, asked whether they funded their school system via a total sum or by category. Approximately 52% of the VACO members responded. Of those 52%, 56% appropriated by total amount, 44% appropriated by category. And then again, there's some note that several counties noted that they're considering moving from appropriation by total amount to appropriation by category. And again, when you look at that, I asked our auditors a little bit, is there any rhyme or reason? And it doesn't matter if you're a big division, you're a big county, small county. You know, again, some large counties fund by total only, some large counties fund by classification, and vice versa for small. There's no rhyme or reason necessarily. What are the potential determining factors of this decision? It could have a determining which way to go, which way to fund. It could have a state of relations between the Board of Supervisors and the school board, or the availability of and willingness to dedicate staff resources at the county level to provide additional oversight of the school division budget. So potential pros and cons of funding by total sum. A pro could be provides the school division with a lump sum amount of funding and leaves the details on how to spend that amount to the school board. Another pro, again, reduce staff burden on county employees to review the different categorical expenditures and needs of the school division. And then one con, the Board of Supervisors has reduced control over how the school division allocates appropriated funds. And then some potential pros and cons of funding by category. A pro would be allows the Board of Supervisors to exert more control of the school division expenditures and prevent the school board from allocating resources away from certain categories that the county deems to be priorities. A con could be requires greater county staff involvement and oversight of the school budget process. And another con could be may contribute to degradation of board supervisors, school board relations. So as a high level, that's kind of what we have, just kind of what's there from a state code level, how we do it now, just looking at, what's kind of the norm across Virginia localities. Again, you can't, as you see, it's not heavy going one direction or the other. It's kind of split in the middle. I think from Dr. Gretz's standpoint, there would certainly, as we fund right now, we fund from a total only standpoint. And so from that, a little bit, it would require a little more planning ahead if there's any type of, appropriations or transfers or supplementals that are needed between the categories. And again, this discussion here, if the board remembers, this topic came up towards the end of budget season, and at the time we didn't really want to, discuss, implementing something towards the end of the budget season. So the board asked to bring this back in September. We were looking at either between this meeting or the first meeting in October. And really, this is just, informational for the board, just kind of really understanding, what's allowable. And then, hearing from Dr. Gretz too, and kind of, how that would affect, what they do. So again, I'm happy to answer any questions from the board, and Dr. Gretz is here. And again, the one thing I would say, if the board, if there's any inclination of the board to go from total only to maybe a major classification, there's two things that would need to be done. I think one, at some point prior to budget season or right at the beginning of budget season, if the board is deciding to change from total only, maybe there's a discussion with the school board, but I think maybe a formal vote of the board to kind of indicate their willingness to go that direction. And certainly from a formal standpoint, once the budget is adopted, again, when the board approves the budget resolution, it's approved from a lump sum amount for the schools. And so if we went from a total only to a major classification, that resolution would include a breakdown of whatever key classification amounts that were in the school's budget. So I think that's just kind of the groundwork for why this is coming up again. It's just kind of a rehash that the board wanted to bring back and, you know, well in advance of budget time. So happy to answer any questions for the board, and then Dr. Grubbs is available as well.
Question?
Did you have anything you wanted to throw on top of what Eric presented there?
Well, first of all, thanks for inviting me to be a part of it. I mean, I have a lot of things I can say about this. I would say there's probably two categories maybe that we would look at. One would be like how do people feel about it? You know, if you're asking me how I feel about it. The other is just functionally, how does it work, regardless of how anybody feels about it. The only thing I would say is, from a functional standpoint, I don't think this would really change the way we do business. It certainly wouldn't change the way I make decisions about the budget. It wouldn't change. It would do very little. It would impact my job very little. I think it would probably have even less impact on the school. The change would be that there would be some added administrative work to about four folks in the finance office.
And the county's finance office.
Well, certainly, yeah, I'm just speaking from the school standpoint.
Sides, yeah.
Yes. I think this is the first time I'm seeing this necessarily, but this list of pros and cons, I think, is good. I might not state some of those things that way, but the only difference from my point of view is it really doesn't change any of the accounting of any of the funds. Everything that's being accounted for now would still be accounted for in the same exact way. There's no expenditures, revenues, nothing that would be suddenly brought to light that isn't now brought to light through our monthly reports to you and what's in our report packet. So there's nothing new there from an accounting perspective. And there's no impact on the bottom line. I mean, the end result is the end result still. What changes is the route. There's a little bit quicker route maybe for the schools to do this. I think the emphasis would be it gives the Board of Supervisors some control that right now you don't have. If we want to make a categorical transfer, we don't have to ask permission for that. You see it. You know about it. It's reported to you. We don't have to ask permission. So the question I would ask is that something you feel the need to have control over? I think we do maybe two of these a year.
That was going to be my next question. If you could maybe describe the last four or five categorical transfers, why they were done and what the amounts were.
So
I know I'm putting you on the spot.
No. It's okay. Yeah, I can't give you numbers, but typically for us, because we don't do a lot of these, and I think I'd have a different disposition towards this if we did. That's one of the reasons I'm saying I don't think it changes that much, because we aren't doing a lot of things. At the beginning of the year, so we're getting ready to build a budget. We build a budget based on how many field trips we think we're going to take next year. We really don't know how much the fuel is going to cost associated with those field trips. I don't know yet what our bus driver rates are going to be or anything else like that. So there are a lot of unknowns. And so in the beginning of the year, we run a mock payroll, and that payroll, insurance is a big unknown as well. We don't know who's going to take what insurance and what plans might change, who we hire and what insurance they might take. So in the beginning of the year, sometimes there is the need to do a categorical transfer to cover those expenses. And I would say that's less at the beginning of the year. It's more an issue at the end of the year when there are potential payouts that we wouldn't have been able to plan for retirements, payroll associated with summer school, potential fluctuations in fuel costs, like I said, associated with field trips, things like that. And I think, so if you look at what we've done, I think that's it. And in the course of a $50-some million budget, I mean, they're tiny. They're very, very small categorical transfers for whatever that's worth. So I think, you know, one of the things that, and just based on my experience, one of the things that I've seen, I'm not suggesting this is at all part of your decision or your consideration. One of the things I've seen is either a disagreement between the two boards, the schools and the county, about how money is being spent. And most often, you would see that in maybe a county believing that the schools are spending too much on administration and what their view of administration would be, right? Too many leaders, paying them too much. We don't have control over that. We're going to control it by funding that category specifically, the admin, attendance, and health category, differently so that we can control what you're doing with administrators. Again, I'm not suggesting at all that's what we're talking about. I'm just saying that's something I've seen. I don't perceive that that's something we have. That's never been socialized among the two boards. I don't think that's an issue. I'm not speaking for you. I think when you have questions about what we're proposing or even what we're spending money on, you ask them and we answer them. So I don't think that's true. One issue with that, I will say, is that there's often a misunderstanding. I agree with Mr. Dahl. I think that they're pretty self-explanatory, but they're not 100% self-explanatory. A lot of people think administrators are all in the administration category. They're not. Principals are in the instructional category. A lot of people are surprised to know that school psychologists are not in the instructional. They're in the admin, attendance, and health. Nurses are in the admin, attendance, and health. So it's not all exactly what it appears to be. The other would be, so one would be a desire to have a little more control because of the disagreement the way money is being spent. The other would be also a disagreement in the way money is being spent, but not what's being spent on so much as our school division scrambling around at the end of the year making unplanned, frivolous, large purchases to try to buy down the end of the year money. We don't do that. We don't make those purchases. And if we did, you'd see them. So, from my perspective, just coming back to the original question, it's going to have very little impact on me. It'll have very little impact on the school board. It will impact the staff that are processing. There will be, you know, my concern would be with the timeline. If we do have invoices to address, needs to address, payroll to address, if that's coming up in June, we've got to get it done before July. And so if we have to ask again, we do very few of these. So I think there's a little bit of a circular question where you could ask me, why is this a big deal? If you're only doing a couple of them, why is it a big deal? It's the peak grants, it's not. It's not a big deal. And then the schools could ask, we'll only do a couple of these, or we're not doing anything out of the ordinary. Why is it a problem? I think.
So in terms of averages, I'm sure you probably know this number, and I think in the past, maybe 10 or 11 years ago, you know, administrative costs seemed slightly out of line with kind of the average for school districts and so on. Do you know where we fall right now in terms of administrative costs? I hate to put it just in administrative, but categorically speaking.
You're talking about this category.
Yeah, that category, but categorically speaking, if you looked at our categories and match them up as a percentage of school budgets in relationship to sort of your typical school of our resources and our size, do you see anything that's out of whack?
I don't. I mean, our schools, like most schools, most of our budget, 80-some percent of our budget is spent on personnel costs. The lion's share of those personnel costs are instructional. So, I mean, that's...
It seems odd to me. And I get that might be, some of these negatives might be why some municipalities do it. It was odd to me to find out that we do that differently with the schools than we do with our own staff. And we don't allow our departments to move money around from one to the other. This is 50% of our budget. And good accounting is the absolute opposite of emotion. And so whether it's over issues or not, every public company out there, publicly traded company, that would have 50% of their spend that they don't have that they have one level of control control and scrutiny over 50% of the spend that they don't have over the other 50%, it's so black and white to me that it's hard to even have a conversation over whether disagreement or concern is a part of it. I don't disagree or have concern with all different departments in Fluvanna County that are under Mr. Dahl. I also expect that we have certain scrutinies that that we don't completely have with the schools. And when you have, according to Mr. Dahl, several years ago, almost 50% of the municipalities in the state of Virginia that do this, and that others were contemplating it. And I think, didn't you say our auditor said that of all the municipalities he deals with, roughly 50%, you would guess, are doing catamarans?
Well, yeah, I mean, of the ones that they do, and then that kind of aligns too with VACO's survey that they did of members. It's, again, the ones that do, of those 52%, 56% do total, only 44% do by category. So,
and so that's not, I don't in any way believe that many municipalities in the state of Virginia, just call it 50%, are doing it because they felt somebody was doing something wrong. I suspect that most of them felt it was just a good accounting practice, as we do in so many other categories. So I think we're going to the emotion side sometimes in this conversation, and I'm missing where we're just not going to the accounting side.
Well, that's why I asked the question, you know, what's the total transfers between categories? If you were, you know, if we're talking millions of dollars, that's one thing. If you're talking 50,000, 100,000 on an $80 million budget, you know, why are we putting in additional, you know, levels of work and energy and effort in order to address, you know, what is in particular in our contingency funds? You know, I mean, it's sort of like, okay, it's a contingency amount and it's a transfer that I imagine, and these transfers are being talked about and reviewed with the school board as well, too. So,
have to approve.
You know, you have another body that's looking at it.
That's elected. That's not appointed. That's elected. So I would like to know how many of the groups that do this have appointed school boards. Not that that makes any difference. Versus elected school board. I mean, if they do the exact same election that we did,
I think,
and for that purpose, to be in charge of that budget.
In all the years that I've reviewed, you know, school board budgets, there was, and I did like this, and I think this was like a level of reporting that, you know, it was kind of important, but it was really around technology spending. It was about transfers around technology spending. And, you know, at that point in time, like, we were arguing whether, you know, a Chromebook was the equivalent of a pencil and whether it should be, you know, the CIP or whether it should be the regular budget. So there were some numbers that were kind of moved around from that standpoint. And I think Mr. Dahl's predecessor, Mr. Nichols, you know, kind of created a chart showing, you know, how the categorical spending had changed over the years. So, you know, in my opinion, if you say, well, you know, a well-oiled machine on average are spending X million dollars on, you know, construction, X million dollars on transportation, X million dollars on this, you wouldn't expect to see a major shift in any of those categories at that point in time. I think when he ran that report, you know, this was years ago, you know, the shift was primarily, correct me if I'm wrong, around technology. Mm-hmm. But that was also when
technology
spend was really increasing inside the county too. So, mm-hmm. You know,
you went from non-existent to almost everyday function.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would be different about those items? And, you know, you're saying that the school some of the move around is marginal. But isn't that true with our directors too and our different departments? Why do we have a different level of scrutiny?
Here would be one question I had about that. Keep going back to businesses, we'd have to do the accounting. In your business, you have an elected group, basically the same level you are, that's in charge of that. You don't.
Well, I would just disagree on the same level because one group asks for the funding from the other. And the group that they asked for funding from
them the order away and let them do their own taxing.
But we're not there. So,
since we're not there,
I'm accountable to the taxpayer, and if the taxpayer says, hey, what about the county that the school said they're going to, they came to you and said they're going to spend X amount of money for some stuff, and it seems they didn't spend that for it. Chris, why did that happen? And I say, I don't know, you're going to have to ask the schools. And they said, no, but wait a minute, Chris, you're the one that decided you appropriate that funding out of my paycheck.
Here's the thing that I would say is, if in fact we're talking about a few $100,000, 1% is $800,000. Right? So let's say it's $100,000. That's 1/12% of the total budget. Why are we occupying our time and energy on that 1/12%? Why are we occupying staff's time? Why are we increasing government?
Well, I don't know where the numbers come from.
That's why I asked the question. I said, how much is the categorical spending? How much have we done? And to me, that would be the thing. If there was a real differential there, and I think Dr. Gretz brought that up earlier, saying, if there is a level of distrust, or there's a lot of these transfers that are happening, then that raises eyebrows. But if you present to the board and say, in the last 5 budget years, these have been our categorical transfer spending, that would be some transparency that would allow us to make a better decision. But in my opinion, if we're talking sub 0.5%, I just don't know why we're worried about that on an $80 million budget. And the big difference local directors here and his is he has the largest staff in the county, right? And so just variations in staff and spending, of course, on the fuel side can be very significant, as well as money that come in from the timing of the money that come in, which presents some difficulties.
That would just be a one headache that I would see for us. It could end up being a headache for us.
I don't want to spend
time. They're under a time.
We
don't have to call special needs in order to approve stuff.
For a while. But I mean, so we don't do a lot of transfers every year, and the debate was going on about how much time and effort. Do you not, in the finance department, have to make an adjustment inside of Munis when they make the transfer anyways?
Yes.
So you're doing it already?
We are.
And with the track was a prime example of, you have an emergency, we accommodate it. And if it doesn't happen once or twice a year, I don't see why we're going round and round on this. Now, the questions I have would be, what's your largest one you've done in the past 5 years? What's the smallest one you've done? What's the scope? What's those numbers in relation to Bigman? And I do understand a bulk of your budget is in the payroll category for staff.
Absolutely.
But the thing that I find really hard, and where I have my question, is I got the school's budget pack, and when I compare it to the budget pack I get from the county offices, they're two different things. I know where you're spending the money. When I see the school one, I couldn't tell you how much was in each of those 6 categories. When you guys brought up...
If there's something different that the board wants us to provide, we can do it. We have a list of very specific expenditures and revenues every month.
And I'm sure...
Everybody can see every pencil we buy.
And maybe I'm not getting where that information's at, and a lot of the constituents are, because they asked me the exact same question.
Yeah.
Eric puts a book in the library. There's one in the county offices. You can look it up online. The school board one, I didn't even think the accounts payable reports were there until I discovered you have to go onto this site, click down, go to the bottom agenda, click another link, go here, and then I can see the accounts payable report. But the overall budget, I don't see that, the spreadsheet version of the breakdown. And when we had our joint session, I was kind of shocked when you, I wasn't against it, paying the janitorial staff what they were, but now what our janitorial staff makes, so for 2 people working for the same county, getting their paychecks paid by the same taxpayers to have a disparity in the wages, I find that kind of shocking.
There are a lot of those disparities on both sides.
Yeah, and I find it amazing, because I was working for the county when we did a pay study, and and we look at other localities, when and we never looked at each other, when we're really competing for the same ones. You want to hire a grounds guy? I want to hire a grounds guy. We're fishing in the same pond. That we should, that transparency should be there, and a grounds guy for the school should be making the same as a grounds guy for the county. The grass is the same.
I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, all of our salaries are posted.
Yep, and I'm not saying I want to cut anyone's salary.
Sure.
But I think in the terms of equity, that two people work for the same county should be making the same thing.
And many would argue that their insurance costs should be the same.
Yep.
But how are you going to cut a lot?
You can't.
Right. I mean, I'm just saying, like, okay, great. So, you know, you just, all you can do is you say $50 million goes to personnel.
But by the same token, yeah, if we're paying for janitorial staff more than they are, then the question's asked to the school board, and I've reached out to James Kelly and say, hey, maybe you guys should pay your people a little bit more.
They're totally different questions. Yeah. What I'm saying is that's different than, you know, whether or not this, the board of supervisors creates another layer of attention in, you know, an $80 million budget where maybe we're talking about 0.1% or 0.12% deviation. To me, we've got enough stuff to do, and I have enough faith in the school board and their and what they're doing that I don't particularly see that as a good use of our time or staff's time. If there was distrust,
so great.
If there was distrust, I'd go for it. But if it wasn't, there's not a lot of distrust.
What is a 1 to 10 to one? You say 1 to 10 to the 12?
If you heard me, I said, you know, you could present, you know, the last 5 years of the capital transfer, I mean, the transfers, mm-hmm. then we could determine that. He said it was a relatively small amount, right? So I'm assuming, you know.
What were the individual amounts, Dr. Gretz? Do you know off the top of your head?
Come on, man. You don't have that budget memorized.
I'm just saying, $800,000 is 1% of $80 million.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, if I cut his number in half and say a small amount for Dr. Gretz is $400,000, that's 1.5%, right? Right? It's 0.5%. So I
don't know what it is.
I'm saying, I don't know that it is, but I'm saying that would be important for us to know if we're looking at this and saying, why are we creating a layer of bureaucracy? We're not doing it.
If it was 0.2% with county staff, would you say we shouldn't have that level of scrutiny?
0.2%?
If within the county's budget, if it was 0.2% that they were moving around funds or whatever, like, my point is comparing the scrutiny of one compared to the other. Should we not have as much scrutiny as we have over direct county funds, the spending under county administrator? Mm-hmm. Should we not have that level of detail there?
Well, we do, in a sense, because we have a personnel contingency fund, right? So, you know, there's movement. And all of those offices have relatively small turnover. You know, a lot of the staff has been there for a long time. There's not a lot of changes. You know, there's not maybe, you know, having to determine, well, gee, all of a sudden we had 150 kids more sign up and we gotta, you know, go ahead and find another 20 teachers for this. You know, so the variation and the impact is pretty significantly different in terms of how that plays out.
So
that's just my, you know, my opinion on this. So.
Dr. Gretz, where would a citizen or a board of supervisors member go to look to see these transfers on your website?
Go to the board packet.
Inside the board.
I'm guessing it's the same as what we get when we get board packet, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for them, because I think, do you have your budget report in there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, you could probably go in there and you could see, I mean, I know for
invoices, expenditures.
Yeah,
revenues.
I mean, I know for us, for the schools,
claims.
We know what they started off at the year from the categorical amount and then what each year it ends at. And so, I mean, you know, have there been transfers? Yeah, but I can't even remotely call, again, since I haven't been the exact weeds of the finance.
It hasn't been one that's eye-catching where $1 million going from one spot to another spot.
No.
I think the big thing, and this would make it easier, you could sway me by providing the same level of detail up front that Eric does, because if I can defend it to the constituents, you would not believe the number of times people say to me, I have no problem paying more in taxes, I just need to know where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
And they can see part of it, but they can't see the other part, or they don't know how to get to it. Same problem I have. And it's like where we were discussing the census survey to find out what we're going to have as an intake problem going forward. And we had a big debate, it must have been 15 minutes. We were talking, is it you guys or is it us? I really don't care where it happens. I just want to see it happen. But having that transparency where, you know, I can go to the people and say, look, this is why we had to do this, then it makes it a lot easier for me to get on board with not changing things if we have that level of transparency. Or that level of where people can find it and it makes sense.
I mean, I want to make it clear. I'm not here to sway you about anything. I didn't come here to convince you to do something or not.
But you're a part of the conversation.
Yes, absolutely. But I just want to make that clear. And I'm not representing the school board.
No.
They have not discussed this.
No, exactly.
Dr. Rex, how do you mentioned that this would, something like one of these transfers we're talking about. Well, let me preface that with one question. So if you were moving, say you have line items for IT, and you're moving money from one, say, sub-line item in IT to another sub-line item in IT, that's not something that, maybe this is more of an Eric question. Okay, it would be only if you were pulling from food services and, say, going from people with transportation.
That's what categorical
got.
Yeah. You're not going to see the individual within the technology major classification.
Right. Making sure I understood that correctly. So these categorical transfers, so they're on the consent agenda, it sounds like, correct?
Yeah, they are. Mr. Whitner is just pulling it up, and on the consent agenda has all the reports on there.
It's called review and approval of monthly claims.
Yeah.
And all the spreadsheets are on there.
How do you determine what's sort of put forth as its own individual discussion item on an agenda versus what's in the consent agenda that I don't, admittedly, I don't listen to every school board meeting. I do listen to a few, but I know ours mostly. I mean, there might be once every couple meetings where someone might pull an item, and we might have discussion on that. But if there's 10 items and we do have a discussion on one, it might just be one. So how do you kind of determine what gets its own sort of standalone action item versus what is included in the consent agenda is what I would call sort of a, I don't want to call it a log rolling type legislation,
sure,
but an omnibus type action matter there.
Yeah. Well, it's hard for me to make a blanket statement about that, but I would say all of our supplemental appropriations are pulled out individually. They're part of the budget report. And the same thing would be true of a categorical transfer. I don't know that it would be its own independent action item, but it's definitely pulled out, and it could be. It just depends.
So unless a school board member were to pull that consent agenda item for its own discussion, there would never be any sort of general discussion from those five members about that transfer.
There could be.
If they
pulled it, never would. Right. If they didn't pull it, sometimes. Okay. Sometimes they would be.
Okay.
I think they have to specifically approve any transfer from the categories.
I think it would be instructive and helpful for the board if we did like a 5-year, because I imagine you have it, you can just go ahead and change your spreadsheet, your balance sheet. Used to the budget process, making decisions that aren't necessarily healthy decisions in the long run. I think our job is to just make sure that there's nothing crazy going on. That's technically the school board's job, but our job is to oversee the school board as well too. And
sure.
There's nothing crazy, then that's.
I'd say that sometimes it's good to have not been in the game for so long, and therefore you question some stuff that maybe you do if you've been in. And so having fresh perspective and asking questions that probably a new perspective is often good. And I continue to ask, and I'm not sure if I'm getting it, what is different? This is just a 2 + 2 = 4. Getting rid of emotion and everything. What is different about this group than the other categories in the county and within good traditional accounting practices? I just don't know that this level of scrutiny or detail in numbers is often not there in a publicly traded company. And I go back to, if you have roughly 50% of the municipalities that say that you're doing it, then it's not over distrust. Clearly, many of them feel that they should meet the criteria that, that businesses and good accounting practices meet. I want to ask you, is there ever sort of, somebody said to me, one of the larger categories you expect within the schools would be that, as far as money that didn't get spent, would be in labor and the cost of staff. So if you're down, the scenario that was given to me was something like, if across the school system, if you were down, if you average being down 10 staff members, whatever that position is over the year, and if you just said those 10 rounded out to 60 grand a piece, or call it 65, that's, let's call it 70.
Probably call it 80 with benefits and everything, 80 to almost 90 almost fluctuates. So
it depends on if you're talking about maintenance, you're talking about school bus drivers, you're talking about teachers.
So let's just
call teacher, you're looking at about 65.
Yeah.
So let's just call it, let's call it 2 cents on the tax rate.
Mm-hmm.
If one, wouldn't it be the case that that would be one of the higher categories where funding didn't get spent? I mean, it would seem that, how many employees total do you have?
500.
Yeah, so over 500, it would seem that there'd be 10 positions at least throughout the year that didn't get filled. On a point, if you just average it out, if you call that,
it's less.
Okay.
Honestly.
But
go ahead.
The principal.
Sure.
So, and if you, I mean, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars, no matter how much, it's a little less or whatever. And is there ever times when that money is moved from that category to a different category?
Well, that I just want to make sure we're talking apples and apples. There is no category devoted to staff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're spread throughout the different categories.
Okay.
Yeah, you have labor on this screen. You have labor in each one of those categories.
Yeah,
you have
IT
staff. You have staff that is doing operations and maintenance.
Sure.
And I
don't want to nitpick words, but I mean, I do think it's significantly less than 10.
Let's call it 7.
Yeah,
let's call it 6.
I think it's closer to 3 or 4, but
so
maybe
let's just
matter.
Round it out to 5.
Okay.
And let's call that 1 cent on the tax rate.
Okay.
So on that 1 cent on the tax rate, is there, just a straight question, is there money that's moved from staff positions that didn't get filled for that year to other spend?
I can't sit here and tell you that's never happened. I would want to, first of all, I'd want Ms. Grasser to be here, and I'd want us to have the opportunity to go back and look at all of our expenditures, but that's not something that routinely would.
I mean,
that would be part of what's returned to you.
Right, you get that return, but I mean, for example, one example where I could see that happening is when fuel costs skyrocketed, right? You know, you just didn't have control over that. They spiked up.
Sure.
You know, you didn't have your budget in that side was probably low at
mm-hmm.
that point in time. So, you know, if that's your largest piece, then that's more likely to do something like that. But again, I think that's where, you know, a list of the category of spending or even just providing those transfers as part of our consent agenda so that we can review it, you know, might be sufficient as well.
And if I understand what you're asking, maybe the spirit of what you're asking, unfunded positions, even if they were, even if we were to say we didn't fill 5 positions, let's take the money that was devoted to those 5 positions and spend it on X.
Yeah.
There's no guarantee that would come out.
But it could.
Sure.
So if you had open teaching positions, you and that money was there, you could shift that conceivably to, let's call it technology, and that could be shifted over to that category at this time without, I guess, without us being able to overlook that and be provided some sort of rationale as to why that money that we provided in that specific area, or however it was that you packaged it, was shifted to another category when it was, again, I don't want to say sold to us as sure. You were trying to make it, you know, seem like you needed these positions and you didn't, but you ultimately wanted that. I don't think there's any of that gamesmanship going on here, but when you get to the end of the year, it's conceivable that that could be shifted to one of the other six categories rather than asking us for it in carryover. Is that correct?
Your question is, are we able to do that?
Yes.
So the answer is yes. If your question is, are we doing it, I would say no.
So when they ask for carryover, when you all ask for carryover, or when they ask for carryover, that is, I mean, is that not being shifted now because it's not funded based on the six categories? It's just basically a lump sum, and then they set their own categories and their own line items? I'm trying to kind of better understand that because
who do you mean by that?
The schools, I apologize. Now I'm looking at Eric saying, "Hey, I'll look at you and say you all," because I'm not really sure who to ask this question to.
We spend the money in the categories. We budget based on those categories. We report based on those categories,
right.
And not because they always make the most sense, but because the state gives them to us.
And quite frankly, a lot of the carryover for the schools has generally been for one-time expenditures. It wouldn't necessarily go from, we had leftover personnel costs in this budget year and we're going to put it into personnel costs next year. It's normally a one-time thing, so it's not the
school bus.
Not a reoccurring expenditure.
School buses is one of the big things as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking, if you talk about positions, I'm thinking of just in my tenure here, we had a school psychologist position that was vacant for 3 years. Yeah, I don't know how many. For my career, at least two. And so the school board had a conversation about how long do we keep that placeholder and hope we get somebody before we repurpose that. Not moving it without telling anybody, but when we build our budget, do we continue to build a budget with a position that we haven't been able to fill for 3 or 4 years? With the exception of the school psychologist positions, I can't think of a single position that we didn't fill.
I literally looked at the thing the other day. And I think there was one special education teacher that was
great
advertised.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably where somebody had to go and walk away or something like that.
So you're already pretty adequately able to fill all your positions.
Yeah, we're doing pretty well with that.
So 2 years ago, we made a huge jump so that we could compete. You've heard me talk about that.
Yeah.
When we have to compete, 3 of the top 9 salaries people in the state are within a 40-minute drive of us. Charlottesville, Alabama, and Henry
Cole. Dr. Gretz, earlier you mentioned, and Mr. Fairchild, I mean, you kind of alluded to the emotional aspect of it and taking emotion out of it when you're budgeting, but and I'm not, I agree with you to a certain extent there, but I want to better understand, I mean, in a small town, small community where you know, we all know each other and see each other every day. It's important, I think, to understand, and I want to understand better. You've said yourself, and I'm being careful in saying this because I'm not trying to act like I'm using your words as a sword against you. I'm trying to articulate and get to my point here and have you sort of explain the emotion that's obviously and clearly involved here. You yourself said that it really wouldn't change very much, and that it really wouldn't cause any extra work, and that it may
for me
for the schools, and that it, but that some of that extra work, which has to go through finance anyways.
I think from an extra work standpoint, and then let me say this: it's not like it's catastrophic. I mean, I think you're talking about if they have budget transfers, you know, there's an agenda item that has to come before the board, so it's extra agenda items. It's probably the bulk
of it.
It
would be similar to what we do with the CRA.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and you said it would have very minimal impact, and that maybe once or twice we may have to approve something here for us that may add an agenda item or two a year. What is the emotional? why, obviously I don't think any members of the school board would, if you, their first answer would be, yes, please do this. And that you know, I think it's pretty clear where some of the folks on this board stand on where we should potentially go with this or where maybe we should go with this. I'm trying to understand if it is seemingly, and I don't want to put words in his back in his mouth from budget season, but I remember Dr. Kelly sort of articulating almost what you said of it not being this sort of huge, what's the emotional piece? Why would there be an emotional response to us doing this if it is been described as sort of this minimal sort of change?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do want to clarify, I'm saying it would have very little impact on the meeting.
Okay.
So I don't know that I would agree that it's emotional. It can be. And please don't think I'm being adversarial about this, but in my experience, I would believe and double down on the statement that I believe probably almost every one of those 50% at least began with distrust or a need to control. And that has been my experience, having worked for boards that do both. That's been my experience working for a board in Middlesex, a board where I went, and they did categorical funding. And there was very little trust between the boards. It was, and I don't mind saying, a catastrophe. And right before I left, they came to me. I didn't ask. They came to me, and they wanted to move away from it because they were kind of tired of getting in the weeds of that. I did a simple Google search. I'm not going to read it to you, but I'm just curious. If you just do your own research, the people who have just done this, Lexington, Frederick, Fredericksburg, Spotsylvania, the people who are talking about this, you read the quotes from the supervisors, and they say it is because of either distrust or a desire to control or a need to make sure the schools are doing what they said they would do. I believe that that is at the heart of every one of these decisions, and it definitely is at the heart of every one of them that I've ever been a part of. I am not saying that is why you're doing it. I'm not. I think the emotional part of it is because, and I'll use a quick analogy. If my son comes to me and he wants to go to the movies with his girlfriend, and I give him a certain amount of money, and I say, okay, what do the tickets cost? How much do you need for food? What are the tickets? You know, how about gas? And I allot a certain amount of money for that. If my expectation is, I want to know what you spend it on, so bring me receipts. But the reality is, if you get there and we thought tickets were $10 and they're actually $8, can you take that $2 and buy a chicken sandwich instead of a hot dog now? I'm okay. You don't have to call me and ask me. I'm okay to do that. And if that's the way we operate, I'm not trying to turn this into a joke. I really am not. I'm really trying to paint a picture. If that's the way we operate for a year, and suddenly I come to him and I say, I don't want you to do that anymore. I want you to call me. If you're going to move a nickel from what we say you're going to put in the gas tank to what we say you're going to buy for food, what happens is, and this was on the slide. I didn't even come up with that. The con a lot of times that's associated with moving to this is a degeneration in the relationship. And I'm not suggesting there would be any emotional response from me. It's not going to change how I do business. What I have seen in other localities, and I encourage you to talk to your colleagues about it. If you want to talk to the people in Middlesex, I'll give you their contact information. I have great relationships with those people. John Lumpkins, who's the Commonwealth Attorney, was the board chair when I was superintendent in Goochland. What happens a lot of times is that communicates to people, whether it's accurate, that communicates to people the level of distrust. I may not distrust my son, but it looks like I do. And the other thing I'll say is, I'm not assuming that distrust is always a negative thing, right? I mean, sometimes caring for people is not trusting them. So you don't know me that well. Some of you know me better than others. I don't take it personally. If you feel like you need to verify what I'm doing, it doesn't bother me at all. I think right now, I'll just try to be concise, but I think right now we have a great working relationship from Pete Kretz's perspective between the two boards. And there's great communication, and I would hate for something to be communicated to the public that there's a thought that schools are doing something they shouldn't do with their money, because I'm confident we aren't. Or schools are hiding something. Or we feel like we need to have more control or more accountability. And for that to send the message that there isn't that trust. And then, another locality where I've been, if my son thinks that he's not going to be able to make a decision to buy a ticket for $1.50 more because he's got to get me and maybe he can't get me, whatever it is, then what I would never want my son to lie to me about the price of the ticket, because he wants to make sure he has a little cushion because he doesn't want to get in trouble. And I am not suggesting the schools would ever do that. I promise you, I would never do that. But that happens. Schools start padding what they're asking for, counties start distrusting what they're being asked for, and it becomes, and that only takes 1 year for that to happen. And then nobody knows who's asking for what or why they're asking for what. And that, my preference is, and I feel like I've done this, I can be painfully honest with you about what we need, what we want, how much it costs, to the tune of, we're going to be talking, when we get out ahead of the board meeting, but we're talking about getting like 0.7% back out of a 50-some million-dollar budget, that for me to overspend, I'd go to jail for that. I mean, if I didn't trust, and the boards didn't trust, I would make sure that we had a little more than 0.7.
Yeah. Can I ask you?
Yes.
If you, the CEO of a publicly traded company, that's how you work with your son in the evening. Would you work with the CEO of the finance of the company the same when you go to work the next day?
I've got to be honest with you. I have no frame of reference for that.
Wouldn't you assume that you would not, that there's not as much trust factor in managing the funds of a publicly traded company as there are with your son when he goes out to the movies?
Again, I don't even want to pretend. I don't understand or know that world at all. The analogy, it's a rough analogy, but everything my son in that case would be spending, I'm getting a report of that. I'm hearing about it. If he makes a categorical transfer from tickets to food or gas to food, whatever it is, I'm hearing about it. He's just not asking me before he does it. So I might feel like I need to move because I want to prevent something from happening.
I think what you're getting at, and this might provide sort of a better analogy, I guess, former educator to educator, you and I have had a lot of good conversations. I think what you're trying to articulate, Chris, is that maybe the better analogy for you to put your shoes in would be, you would, in that analogy, and again, I think it's a great analogy, I don't think any of us are making light of this situation, but it's the analogy we've got, it's the analogy that's on the table. You give your son $20 to go to the movies, that's Pete Gretz's money, that's Dr. Gretz's money, right? We're not giving them Mike Goad's money or Chris Fairchild's money. I think that's what Mr. Fairchild, I think, is trying to articulate here. So I guess the best analogy would be, if you had money that you were pulling from some sort of trust that maybe your family had set up for you or whatever, and you had to report back to your parents on the money that you spent, I guess the analogy being the taxpayers in this case, and you gave them $20, your son, $20 of that that your parents have given you, and then you have to report back to your parents on how the money was spent, and you can't necessarily tell them, well, I think he got a hot dog, but they were $1, had a $1 sale, so he may have used the other $2 to get a Slurpee. I think that's probably the difference here that maybe you're trying to articulate. It's not necessarily a COO of a company going in, but maybe in your analogy, it's your $20. It's not our $20 in our case. I think is that kind of what you're trying to get at, Chris?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, that's a great clarification. The only thing I would say is that in that case, I could say exactly what he's doing because I'm getting that information. I'm just not being asked. I
think that's where my question comes from. You know, I'm in the same boat that a lot of the constituents come to me, and they ask me, and I go, I don't know, because I don't know where to look. And that doesn't mean that the information's not there. We just need to make it easier. And like I said previously, Most people have no problem with funding the schools. Now, there were, I got some pushback over the track issue. And even when you try explaining it to them, well, if we don't repair this subsurface, there's no warranty. You're throwing money away. Even then, they still don't understand.
Sure.
But at least there was, they could understand what it was we were doing. And this is all the points I was trying to make. Let's try to make it easier and clearer. And I know I've talked to Dr. Kelly on this. And when I talk to him, I get the information I need. But I just would like it to be available easily, where people can easily find it. And I think that clears a lot of the problems up.
Yeah.
Because the people want the same thing that you want and the same thing I want.
Sure.
The best possible schools, and that we're spending the money most efficiently so that our students get trained to the highest level possible with what we have to do.
I'm just going to say one thing really quick. I might not have one absolute thing to do with any of it. But you talked about wants list at the end of the year. I've been there for a long time. 30 years ago, we used to get a wish list at the end of the year. We got X amount of dollars per teacher to spend. If you didn't spend it this year, you got to keep it to the next year. Now, there are no wish lists. The amount of money that we get per teacher has probably been cut in half. And as soon as we get that money, we try to spend that money, because if we don't spend it quick, it'll probably be gone because it's needed somewhere else. So that's the amount of fluff that's in it right now. And I'm telling you that as an educator now, not as a board supervisor. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, we used to get $800 per teacher. Now it's, I think, $400 per teacher. And if we don't spend it by a certain date, like last year we put in orders and we were told, sorry, we got to spend it with this allotment for this thing. So it's gone. But like I said, there are no such things as wish lists. But I can remember, and I had no idea what a wish list was before I got on the board. And now I understand that. But that hasn't happened for 30 years, 25 years. Anyway, like I said,
if, you know, regardless of the decision you make about categorical funding, I would want to make sure that if there are ways that we need to improve the way we're making information accessible. I don't know how to do that necessarily, but I would love to hear that regardless of what.
You said you put y'all spending things in your packet. Mm-hmm. Could you just forward it to us? I mean, I'm just saying, we share a file or something like that, because we get the others.
It's on share file, right?
Yeah, but I mean, if we're like a file, I'm saying just email it, it directly.
We have the categorical transfers and their consent agenda as well, too.
I have a public question.
I got two thoughts real quickly, and that is, one, there are a plethora of bankrupt companies that are well managed that are publicly traded companies. I can think of many. Okay, so just because it's publicly traded doesn't mean there's a problem with that. The second is plumb out of right now, so I'll come back to it. Keep on coming back.
Let me fill that space for you.
I have a good question for you, Dr. Gretz.
Yes, sir.
Is the population study going to be included in your budget you submit this year?
I don't know. Yeah. Forecast.
I'll talk to Dr. Kelly then.
I remember that correctly. You know, that basically you had raised the question of how they could, right? They could take the money and move it from here to there. So could a board of supervisors when we were decided, well, we think 85% of instruction is too much, and we're going to cut to 80%, and we're going to move the money over here.
That is right.
And that can happen. And that is where you build a lot of distrust in between the two boards, right? Because essentially you're inserting yourself in the process where you're not spending. Last time I checked out, I'm going to the school board meeting, nor are you guys, right? And you're not spending the time when the schools are going to look. So you can create that level of distrust. Yeah, you.
That would be during budget season on a request, though. I mean, once the budget's passed and those hypothetically, if you were categorical and those were set, you couldn't go after it's passed and say, I think you're spending too much money here now, and then shift it. Or, I mean, that would be
until we finalize the budget. we can change the budget anytime the five of us decide, or the majority of us decide.
But now you're deciding at which categories you're gonna spend.
I'm trying to articulate that,
there's a funding there, and you've got to reach.
I see what you were saying, it made it sound like you were saying at a drop dead of a moment, you can decide if you wanna make this less. Budget state, right.
So if we weren't above it, we'd be working at county and central.
As far as if we did this, I mean, clearly by this conversation, there's no distrust. And if the schools were to put out there, whoever it was, and whatever their association with the schools, that this was a negative, that was a statement of distrust or an assault on the schools, or however that might be deemed or termed, it clearly is not that. So we can't control that. That would be on whoever would put that message out there, that it would be wrong of them to do so. There's been nothing here that's been said by anybody that's been said, what about what you all did here or there?
Sure.
And we can't control, we have to do what's right. I don't know, you get it. We have to do what's right. You know, sometimes change, I've learned in my business with my employees plenty of times, sometimes you make change and people are gonna be unhappy about it. And then it becomes the way you just have done business for quite a while, and it's just, that's leadership sometimes instead of management. So I would, if we did make the change, I would hope that the schools would maintain the same cordial relationship and not use that in a way that would create that divide.
Yeah, I can't imagine anybody on the school side would do that.
Yeah.
I don't think I wouldn't expect schools or county to be messaging anything about it. What I was referring to is how people interpret it.
Sure.
Yeah.
And by the way, it also seems it's emotional, even if it's distrust from most of that roughly 40-some% from the county side, that's still emotional. Either it's valid, either there's a lot of cases out there that people, that municipalities like ours had to go, whoops, wow, there's a lot going on out there. Or there's enough people throwing red flags, or it's emotional, and so whichever side is emotional about it, it seems to suggest by your assessment that, and it could be, that the mass of that is an emotional trust conversation. And that's where I get lost in the whole thing of back to good accounting practices. I'm not sure I'm legitimately, I mean, I'm not sold that we need to do this. I'm legitimately trying to determine what's different about a school system than everything else we do in government and everything we do in businesses. And I'm yet to hear, maybe it's been said, but I'm missing what that is. So that's just like, that's my struggle.
Well, what I started with, I'm grateful that you asked me to come and have a conversation. Thank you, Mr. Brown. It doesn't impact my relationship with your work.
Amen.
Well, I think you gave us a fair warning that, you know, properly, not done properly, and or that this can potentially result in distrust for not existing. I think you tried to give us that warning. So, yes, it does affect you.
Well, no, I understand. I guess what I mean to say is I'm going to approach my relationship with the county the same way, no matter whether you do this or not. If you feel like you need to do this as a board in order to have a level of comfort, Pete Kratz, speaking for the board, it's important to me that you have that comfort.
Thank you.
If that's what
and I think if you provide that historical category, that would give that.
Yeah,
it's fantastic.
Happy to do it.
Are there any other questions or thoughts from anybody else?
No, I would just like Tony and say that I would like to see what the history of like last 3 to 5 years. I mean, I don't know if you can go back five, but what would those boards have been taking votes on, and what were the reasons and rationales, and maybe when they were passed, and you can go back and if there was discussion and listen to why that money needed to be moved from one place to another, just to give us a better understanding. I will echo something, and I think lend support to the statement that I'm going to make. I'm going to show some cards that I wouldn't normally show and would say that when you say, I'm not going to do something, or Dr. Gretzen, I believe words that come out of your mouth because I think you're one of the most genuine people I've had the opportunity to work with since I've been in this position. And I do trust you. You may not always be here, and I'm not saying that I'm leaning one way or another, but you know, you may not always be here, and I think that at least having an understanding of, you know, maybe we don't go this route. And if someone says, well, why didn't you go this route? Well, we took a look at the last 3 to 5 years, and these were some things that happened, and these were some things that, the reasons that those were made, and those decisions were made, and they seemed to be valid, and we're going to keep an eye on it or do some things a little bit differently so that we have a better idea of when that happens. You know, I think at the end of the day, if we probably had that and then could maybe look at some reporting things. I mean, I don't know where we're going with this direction on a formal vote or anything like that. At some point down the road, I would certainly say that if the vote were tonight, I'd probably be in an abstention just because I don't feel like I have enough information at my disposal to make an informed decision on it. I think some of that. Anything else that you think additionally that could help us make a decision where we to take a vote on this would certainly be helpful from your perspective.
Yeah, roughly 3 months to pass some more of this out right before we're in the budget season, and so
yeah. As long as it's not the last item just before we close the budget.
Thank you, Dr. Grant.
Thank you, Dr. Grant. Right.
Moving on to action items.
Mr. Chair, we actually need to jump to public hearings. This is after
seven. Okay. All right. Moving on to public hearings, item D. Adoption of the 2015 comprehensive plan. Mr. Forge.
Okay. First of all, can everybody hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. Apologies, I'm recovering from a bout of COVID, so I'm just taking precautions. You can go ahead, Eric. So just to remind everybody, the reason we do the comp plans, well, there are a number of reasons, but it's dictated in state code 15.2-2223. Local Planning Commission prepares and recommends the plan, and the local governing body, in this case the board, adopts the plan, and it's basically to guide the territory under its jurisdiction. 15.2-2230 stipulates that a minimum once every 5 years the plan is reviewed to determine whether it's advisable to amend the plan. Just to remind everybody, the county's plan was last revised and adopted in 2015. There was an update underway in 2020, but COVID happened, which kind of shut everything down. You can go ahead and go to the next slide, Eric. So the county's currently out of compliance with state code sections. So what's been happening and what we're trying to do here is a readoption of the 2015 plan, just making some basic changes to sections 2, 5, and 6. And I can go list by list, but just to give you a brief thumbnail, there are some wording changes and a few data changes in section 2, which is your land use and community design, and then sections 5 and 6, some wording changes, and also there are some demographic changes in section 5. There was a lot of employment data, which we did update for this current plan update. You can go ahead, Eric.
And just one thing before you go on to, and again, this is assuming the board approves or adopts this evening. You know, as part of the work plan and the retreat that the board wanted staff to come forward with a kind of a plan and a process to immediately start on the next full-fledged, like, reboot of the current plan. So just a little preface there.
And I think that's covered a little bit on this slide. And just to bring everybody up to speed, and I'll get to that in a second. The Planning Commission did have a public hearing July 9th on the draft plan. They deferred action to August, and it was reconsidered in August, and the Planning Commission did recommend adoption. So once the plan is adopted, to Eric's point, the intent is to begin working immediately on the next plan update with the Planning Commission. And I am expecting that process to take 12 to 18 months. Really, the next Planning Commission meeting after the plan is adopted, my intent is to go before the board and get that process kicked off. As far as tonight, after tonight's public hearing, the board will be asked to take action There is a resolution in the packet for the board's consideration. You can go ahead and go to the next slide. And there's the resolution for your consideration, and I'll take any questions you have.
Can I talk to Mr. Fortune a bit before the meeting got started? But just so some citizens would know that I'm asking the questions they asked. What I've set out, I don't recall any opportunity being offered to the county residents to review and or comment on question the updates. You did have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, so basically for the public hearing and also for the Oxman, especially the public hearing, the draft plan was made available for public viewing, and the public, of course, was given a chance to comment during the public hearing itself. And then again, when we brought it back in August, the plan was also available publicly for citizens to review.
And the second question that I had, where is all the data on rural preservation that the special advisory group sent in both the majority report and the minority report?
Okay. So what he's referring to is there were two focus groups, historic preservation and rural preservation. They both issued reports, and there's also a minority report for each. Not to sidestep the question, that work was all done before I came on board here. My understanding is that some of that was included in the plan update, but
it should be in the appendices.
It's in the appendices.
And have you seen them? That was the last question. Has the new planning director seen these items?
I have looked at them. I mean, I haven't taken a seriously deep dive, but I have looked at both, I guess all four of those.
Thank you.
So for me, just for clarity, we are readopting the 2015 plan with minor modifications, and immediately following this, we will begin a new review cycle, which will take into effect. We'll set up committees or commissions to look at individual portions and involve citizens, staff,
community meeting, yes. All that stuff.
Yes. Yes.
Just to be clear, that question's come up multiple times to me.
Okay. Yeah, and a lot of this was discussed. Obviously, we had a couple planning commission meetings, and some of these same things were brought up there. The way I've kind of understood things and seen the direction on this, just to clarify, is that essentially this is to get us in compliance, and the real bread and butter of the work will come over the next. I mean, I think a lot of the reason we brought Mr. Fortune on board was because of his experience with comp plans and things like that. And we got certainly derailed by COVID and then some other things, a lot of changes on the Planning Commission and unexpected things on the Planning Commission. And so I think this is essentially a move just to get us in compliance. And for the record, the minority report is in the appendices here. So.
Other thoughts and questions?
No.
We need to make sure
we need to make sure we're legal.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
We've got a public hearing. We've got to have a public hearing.
The chair has to open it.
Yep, I did.
Thank you, Dr. Gratz.
Thank you, Dr. Gratz.
All right. All questions are already done from the board. We'll open the public hearing. Please keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Does anybody like to address the board?
Yes.
I'm Kurt Putnam. Live at 16408 James Madison Highway. I'm in Columbia District. Members of the board, I do see the need to update the comprehensive plan. I'm not here to speak against that. I was around in 2015 and participated in the adoption of that plan. And there was a lot of committees and public comments and public participation. I was very pleased at the way it was done. The current update is just a Band-Aid that allows us to comply with the Virginia law, basically. You know, there are deficiencies in the plan and this update that need to be addressed in a planned and well-executed overview of the comp plan. There are multiple references to data from the 2010 census. These should be updated to include 2020 census data and basing decisions on that. The plan should allow for upgrades to public transportation and plan for participation in regional transit authority. That's my personal opinion. And there's a need for a street overlay for development in Zion Crossroads to include walkability and multi-unit housing. I see a need for pre-zoning that area to make sure that what goes in there goes in the right places. The plan should stress the need for affordable workforce housing as well as low-income housing for seniors. It's a pity what some of the seniors are living in. They're trying to stay in their own home because that's all they can afford, and some of them aren't fit to be lived in. I do realize that we are under constraints to adopt the current update and that it should be adopted forthwith. And I'm very pleased to hear that the planning director intends to initiate the procedure to update immediately. Because that's my one concern, basically, was that we didn't wait 5 years to do it again. And this resets the clock. We could do that. I suggest that the board also stipulate in a separate motion that the staff be required to devote the necessary time and resources to initiate an immediate complete review with community input to be completed within 2 years. I see a need to put a time limit on that so that it doesn't get kicked down the road. And that's basically the reason I'm here. But thank you for your attention.
Thank you, sir. Anybody else wishing to speak? Seeing nobody else, we'll close the public hearing.
I know that that's what we've been working towards. We've had meetings and committees and groups set up to work on the comprehensive plan. We're just doing this now. Because it's been 9 years instead of 5 years. And we need to make sure that this is done within the next 18 months.
Yeah, well, that's why I asked the question. But the other thing that would concern me is if we set an artificial time limit and that's maybe not ample time, I would rather have a quality product that took 19 months than something that gets rushed and we miss something. Because there's a few places that we've come across already where we know we need to make updates to our ordinances, and you find out you made a mistake when a developer basically runs through a loophole or an oversight you had in there. So I'd rather go a little bit slower and do it right than to rush it. And you know, if we try going too fast, then sometimes people, you know, conspiracy theorists, you're rushing it to try to stifle people's input and comments, and I don't want that either. I want this to be a community thing.
Well, we haven't stifled anything. We've been taking comments and input from last year on this now. So we've already had it here, and we're already 16 months into it.
I have the ultimate faith in Mr. Fortune that he will deliver us a quality product somewhere in the 12 to 18 months. And you know me from writing things down.
Rather it be right, but like I said, this is not, we're not starting from scratch, right? We've been talking about this for
three of the chapters we've been talking about.
But we've been working towards the, I can't tell you exactly which chapters because nothing's been really brought to us.
So, I mean, if we, by taking this action, you can guarantee that I'll have it written in my book. Next year at this time, I'll be asking the question, and if it's not ready, when we get through budget season, that would be the first question I'll ask again.
Mr. Fortune, can I ask, do you know roughly how many comp plans you've been a part of over your...
I can give you a ballpark, yes. Just in the last, I don't know, probably 3 to 4 years, I've done... At least 5 or 6, just comes to mind right away.
And on average, what would your guess be on how much time on average it took to complete?
I will say the last couple of comp plans that worked on did take
a little. Can I get you just a little second? We've got, I'm just trying to give you all the time to, we're going to be here too.
You got Charlie Horson.
Sorry. And my monitor went out. I had that effect on technology.
Sorry. So I will say, to be fair, the last couple of comp plans I've worked on did go longer than 18 months. Solar was the big holdup on both of those.
Shocker.
typically, it 18 months is really a ballpark. If all goes as planned, I say 12 to 18 months. It really depends on when I start working with the commission, how much they want changed to the current plan. That could affect my timeline, but Until solar became an issue, I would have said 18 months is a pretty good guess. Solar's a wild card.
This is a resolution. Is it any teeth to putting a date on it other than this is what the board said they would like to see?
I mean, Mr. Fortune's going to come back with a plan and what he's proposing for a time frame. Mm-hmm. So maybe at that time when we bring that forward, maybe that's the time if the board says we want some type of time frame or check-in points or something like that.
I guess all the real teeth would be that if it wasn't done by then, just somebody have to make a statement among staff of why it wasn't done.
And I'll say too, I mean, and again, you know, you get some localities that spend big dollars that utilize firms like Berkeley Group and other firms like that, that pay to have outside resources do that, but it's costly. It's costly. But like I said, Mr. Fortune has good experience in this field.
And I said, make a statement to it, I guess, more directly answer to the board why. Hey,
I will tell you, for what it's worth, what I've done with other localities when I work on comp plans, I'll provide monthly updates on what's been done and where things stand.
Good. That sounds good. Yeah. That'll be new.
I think we have a consensus.
Yep. Any more questions?
I move the Board of Supervisors adopt the Flavanna County 2015 Comprehensive Plan 2024 update.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Hyde, second by Mr. Duda. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye, passes 5-0. All right, we're moving on to item E, ZTA 2403, Planning and Zoning Fees. Mr. Duda.
All right, you go ahead and go to the next slide, Eric. So this is an amendment to the county code to amend zoning and subdivision fees, sections 22-17-7 and 19-9-6. For some context, 2018, the last time the fees were updated, so that's 6 years ago. The intent here is to bring the county in line with surrounding localities. So some fees were raised, some were lowered, and other tweaks were made. The expected effect is that it could potentially increase revenue, give or take $25,000. This was presented to the Planning Commission in July. They did defer a month. They had two big concerns, which I'll address here. Lowering the cost of the public hearing sign deposit, they were concerned if it were to cover the costs for replacements. The answer to that is yes. We've already done some math, and a lower fee will cover the cost of the new signs. And then someone had requested a waiver or asked about a waiver process for the fees for conservation easements, saying some people might not be able to afford the fees. We came up with a compromise there to lower the actual fee there as opposed to a waiver process. I discussed this with Dan, and then we felt that would be easier than actually trying to come up with a waiver process. You can go to the next one, Eric. Again, that's the comments on the public hearing signs and the conservation easements. The compromise was to basically lower the fee for conservation easements to $100. So this information was brought back to the Planning Commission in August, and they did vote to recommend approval of the revised fees as presented. And this is a chart. Hopefully you can read this. This is the proposed fee changes. The ones that are being proposed to change are in red. And I won't go down through these line by line. In a number of cases, what we are doing is simply removing additional mailing costs. And the reason is, I discussed this with staff, and the feeling was it was really not worth the staff time to calculate mailing costs it just wasn't worth the time, the money that we'd be getting in the mailing costs, so we're proposing to take those out. Now, with other fees, we're just making changes. The health department subdivision reviews and the system reviews, you notice we're proposing to zero those out. The reason is we don't actually do anything there. The health department does that, so there's really no point in us recouping any costs there. Other than that, I can take any questions you have on specifics.
And if the board has questions, I can bring up. I know it might be hard to see. I can bring up the whole fee schedule if you want to see that. But again, it was important as well.
The part of the just a conversation I had with Mr. Dahl at a citizen emailed me, just basically saying, "Hey, we're working on building a house, and my gosh, these fees." And this is the concern of the citizen is this is basically a form of taxation of are we putting money in the general fund off of this, or just covering our costs? And as Mr. Dahl and I said, of course the want would be that we're just covering our expenses, we're not building the fund off of it. And I'm looking for a way that I don't know what that is even, to be honest, to help ensure to the citizen that
in many cases that don't cover the cost.
Yeah, well, previously, I mean again, some fees, I mean, and again, and Dan, you chime in too from your experience from other localities. I mean, yes, I mean, because I know someone made a point before, okay, well, you already have county staff there. Why are you charging me to do something that we're already paying for county staff? It's not like if when they don't do this, they're going away. But I think a little bit sometimes too, county staff working on something very specific for one individual, that there's time that goes into it, and that kind of takes away some of the other things. And again, this is not that this is maybe the, this is very typical in localities that a homeowner or business gets charged a fee for whatever type of process they are going through because there's administrative cost do so.
I mean, the fee for new single family construction is only $150. I mean, on the building side, you have the building permit fees.
Yeah.
On the zoning side, the fees are not that much for building a house. Now, if you want a special use permit, then the fee is $800. But I just saw in Louisa they were talking about a $2,500 fee for SUVs and raising it 400%. So we're definitely on the lower end as far as the SUP fees, and I think as well on the single family construction fees.
And what you said about the permit, what the person said was their permit for an 1,100 square foot house was $1,200. The question was, why should a homeowner have to pay so much at the beginning when the county only provides inspections and recordings for those things, and also when the homeowner will be paying taxes on said property? Thoughts on?
And most of those are on the building side. I mean, the zoning, you're looking at the setbacks, you're looking at the height of the structure. But it's more the building side. They're the inspectors that are going out there multiple times, re-inspections.
Yes. Plumbing, electric.
Framing.
Yes.
So dry foundations.
And it's not short visits.
Yeah.
So he might be in Kent's store and have to go down to Antioch to do one. They're all over the place.
Yeah.
And they're out all day long. And they still have desk jobs that they have to do in the daytime.
And I can tell you, they come multiple times because when I moved into my house, they literally came out there and said, "This has not been done. You cannot get a CO until plywood is put across the bottom of your floor." And so the young guy that was doing a lot of the work, he and I spent the rest of the day underneath the house, and they didn't move anything in from the house.
You got a floor room?
I did. I can think of one for you, but we don't ever go out there, but it's there.
I have a question, Mr. Fortune. Under application review, the previous one looks like it was 750 plus mailing costs, and it's going down to 100. Is that correct, or is it supposed to be 75 going up to 100?
Actually, which one?
Conservation
easement. Conservation
easement. That's the one. I'm sorry. So conservation easement program, that's the one where we compromise because that's the one where we had a member of the Planning Commission ask if we had a waiver process, and in talking about it with Dan, we decided to compromise, or just lower that fee down to $100.
Other than that, all of it seems to make sense.
Yeah, and again,
I think that's right too.
I don't feel like I have any person to make reference to or try to determine or offer the citizen to help them help give comfort of that fees are breaking.
I think if you showed like an average house how many times an inspector goes out there, probably 20 times, 25 times, that would show the amount of hours.
I got a call the other day from a constituent. They just wanted to put a barn to put a tractor in. No, I don't even think they're going to have electric. But we're charging a $50 fee for that.
That's the setback form.
It's a setback fee determining setbacks.
To cover the cost of the guy of building inspector going out to
the building inspector doesn't
realize that. That's for zoning compliance.
Yeah. Or zoning compliance. Well, one of them's got to go out there and measure.
No, they don't go out there and measure.
We do spot inspections in zoning.
To make sure it's not in the floodplain, check the zoning, check the height,
check
setbacks.
The height, yep.
All right, any other thoughts or comments?
No.
All right. We will now have a public comment. Please keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Anybody wish to comment? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing. Anybody want to discuss?
I move the Board of Supervisors approve CTA 2403 and ordinance to amend 2215-6-63 County Road 29 zoning subdivision.
Did you say 19-6?
Yeah, just
19-9.
19-9-6 County Road 29.
Second.
Zoning and subdivision.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Sheridan. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. All right, so we're going to jump back up to the action items. Is that correct? All right, item B, authorization to advertise dangerous dogs ordinance amendment. Mr. Whitten?
Pull it up on my computer real quick. There we go.
Okay, so the proposed amendment to the county code would repeal section 4-2-3 and enact sections 4-2-3.1 through 4-2-3.6. Related to dangerous and vicious dogs. So the code section has not been amended since 2015. There were significant amendments made to the code in 2019 that weren't reflected in our county code. So the Commonwealth Attorney's Office, who prosecutes the Dangerous Dogs and Vicious Dogs Act, if I could update the ordinance to parallel state code. So when we looked at the state code, a number of new sections have been added, and we also split up the vicious dogs from the dangerous dogs, which is what the state did as well. Kind of, they're handled separately, basically, when you're in court. So if you look at the amendments, the main changes were it extended the time permitted for the court to adjudicate dangerous dog cases, and it allowed the court to defer proceedings with conditions placed on the owner. It also allowed the court to compel implementation of electronic identification if adjudication is deferred, and it limited the appeal of dangerous dog adjudication to 30 days. It also required the owner of a dangerous dog to spay or neuter the dog and to carry liability insurance of at least $100,000 for animal bites. The other amendments included basically if the dangerous dog is found to be a dangerous dog, and they subsequently attack another dog, then it's a class 2 misdemeanor. If the animal is injured or killed, then it's a class 1 misdemeanor if a human is bitten or attacked and injured. And it also created notification requirements for moving or disposing of a dangerous dog, which is a class 3 misdemeanor. And then the new section regarding vicious dogs states that willful act or omission in the care of such dog that causes injury to a person is a class 6 felony. So basically, these changes will make it easier for the Commonwealth Attorney to bring these cases in court, so a defense attorney won't be able to question the county code in relation to the state code. Public hearing will be October 16th, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Okay.
I move that the Board of Supervisors advertise a public hearing to be
Motion's been made. Motion's been made by Mr. Goode, seconded by Mr. Hodge. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Vice Chair votes aye and passes the gavel back to the chair.
Chris, we're a little light with that ordinance.
Oh, God.
All right, item C, 2025 Board of Supervisors meeting dates.
This is a quick one here. So when we brought the budget calendar to you, I think it was a month ago, really looking at the budget calendar. So originally the board meeting was supposed, the first meeting of January was falling on January 1st. So the board approved to move it to January 2nd. Really, when we look at that, the week before that, trying to get any type of board package together, you have the week of Christmas and everything, and just from a staffing standpoint and then getting some time away, what we were proposing to move the two meetings to January 8th and January 22nd. Of 2025, and again, it still gives us 1 week then in between our first meeting in February. The nice thing with January this year, we've got 5 Wednesdays in the month, so it allows us some flexibility. So with that, instead of having the board meeting on January 2nd, it kind of shifts the board meeting away from holiday schedules and stuff a little bit, and we just thought it would be a little more efficient from staff providing some of the necessary materials needed for meetings. So that's it in a nutshell.
Second and fourth. Yeah.
It would be the second and fourth Wednesday.
Yeah, the second and fourth Wednesday. So it would be January 8th and January 22nd.
The color coding is just reflecting holidays.
What's that?
The color coding is just reflecting holidays.
Yeah, the pink on there on the little calendar, that reflects days off, kept the counties off.
Maybe you said, and I was looking at that on my phone, put these dates in January 29th through 31st.
Yep.
Is that what I'm seeing? Budget briefs?
Yeah, that's generally when I would present my proposed budget, go through.
When we do it at
the 2x2. Yeah, 2x2.
Gotcha.
Yep.
So it would be the 15th and the
8th
and the
15th. The
8th
and the
22nd.
Yeah, so instead of the 1st and 3rd, we're moving it to the 2nd and 4th Wednesday.
Did you say the 8th and the 22nd?
Yes.
Yes, sir. You really don't want to come in on the 1st. I don't want to see you guys on the 1st.
No, it'll probably be in a hotel room in Utah.
I move the Board of Supervisors approve moving the January 2025 meeting dates from January 2nd, 2025 and January 15th, 2025 to January 8th, 2025 and January 22nd, 2025 and further reflect the changes in the fiscal year 26 budget calendar.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Hodge and seconded by Mr. Goode. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye, 5-0.
I will tell you how many are missing in February 2nd.
You'll be on a cruise.
You will.
Yeah.
60th birthday and 35th anniversary.
60, wow.
Yeah. Well, some people are there. I thought somebody beat you to it.
Anybody have any items you'd like to pull from the consent agenda?
I move that we adopt the consent agenda as presented.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Goode, seconded by Mr. Hodge. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye, passes 5-0. All right, unfinished business. Any unfinished business?
I have a couple questions. One of them is unfinished. New Abbott building, where are we at with releasing the RFP on that?
We're working on the RFP. We should have it out in October. Beginning of October.
Can we ask a question? I didn't hear.
The admin building RFP.
wondering the status of the application. I think in the retreat we said November deadline, but we should have it out beginning of October.
Any other questions?
Yeah, do we have a, kind of a document compiled from, I forget the gentleman's name.
The retreat?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to be bringing that forward at the next meeting.
Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Payne,
that's right.
Kim Payne just got the document about a couple weeks ago. Him and I have had some back and forth and stuff like that on just a few tweaks to the document, just not changing what was presented, but just
right.
some of the language and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we'll be bringing a draft back at the next meeting.
All right, moving on to new business.
Yeah, so again, we just wanted to give the board a quick update on rural cluster subdivisions. One, just because, you know, we've had a couple that have gone through the Planning Commission, and then two, you know, there was some discussion of that from the board retreat as well. So I'll hit some of this, and Dan, you fill it in if I'm fumbling here. So prior to 2006, Virginia Code Section 15.2-2286 gave localities the option to authorize by right rural cluster subdivisions. In 2006, Virginia Code 15.2-2286.1 was added, which required by right rural cluster subdivisions for cities and counties that had a population growth rate of 10% or more. In addition, in 2011, Virginia Code 15.2-2286.1 was amended to authorize stormwater management areas and access roads for the development to be placed in the open space area. And as of the 2020 census, the county's growth rate was less than 10%, which exempted the county from the rural cluster subdivision requirement. And I guess I'll hand these off to Mr. Fortune here to take on some of these specifics.
Okay. Yeah, and just to remind everybody, for Section 22-4-2.1 of the County Code, rural clusters are permitted by right in A1, which basically means the board has little or no say over rural cluster subdivisions. 22-4-10.3 goes into specifics on the regulations. We don't list them all here, but the more important points to keep in mind is that the total gross density is no more than one dwelling unit for 2 acres. So for instance, if you have 25 developable acres, 12 and a half dwelling units in the rural cluster. Minimum 75% of the land is to be maintained in open space. It does allow some uses in the open space. You can still have a single family parcel, but that residence has to be included in your gross density calculations. I'm not going to go down the entire list here, but certainly agricultural uses, parks, playgrounds, recreation uses, public utilities, public uses, and of course water and sewer can be included in that open space. And just continue on that, for rural clusters in A1, unless the lot is fronting an existing public road, your frontage and setbacks have to follow R4 requirements, which you see on the screen there. For if you have any lot or parcel fronting two or more roads, they conform to the frontage minimum lot with the setback requirements for all such roads. And then that last part is just going through the process through the subdivision ordinance 19-3-2. Again, the board has little or no role here. This is basically done through staff and the Planning Commission. Once staff receives a sketch plan for a rural cluster, we have 30 days to review it and provide comments back to the subdivider. And we have 60 days to actually present it to the Planning Commission and place it on the agenda for their monthly meeting. And then when it's presented to the commission, they have 45 days to review and make comments. And that last bullet point is important. The Planning Commission's role is simply to accept the sketch plan. They're not approving or rejecting, they're just accepting the sketch plan. You can go ahead, Eric. This next slide, it has to do with VDOT. Virginia Administrative Code specific, but it's really VDOT because you may or may not be aware that for a rural cluster to be accepted into the VDOT system, it has to have two entrances. There is a little bit of flexibility here. You can have an entrance to a public road and either an entrance to another public road or a stub out to an adjoining property. That one's important because one of the subdivisions we put before the Planning Commission recently had a stub out. VDOT has not given their blessing on that, and I'm not going to get into specifics there. But as far as that particular requirement, the VDOT district administrator can grant a waiver under certain conditions, and I bring that up because for a roller coaster was recently accepted by the commission, our waiver was granted. Bullet points 1 and 3 there were the grounds for granting that particular waiver. I don't know if you want to just read those word for word. I'll just leave them up there for your consideration.
And then this is just kind of an example of looking at the most recent rural cluster, just to kind of give you a high-level overview. This is our Rivanna Bend, which
yes.
was the rural cluster that was just approved at the back of Sycamore Square. So again, this is what they use for the yield plan, and you can see all the lots as part of this yield plan are 2 acres or greater. Mm-hmm. And so from that, once they determine how many lots can fit in that, you can see right there, it's 76.71 acres, and you can fit 22 lots in there, which provide greater than 2 acres. And so then, how does that rural cluster then get fit into the remaining parcel? And that is the layout. Once you take 75% of the parcel, and then you back out, what is it, steep slopes?
Mm-hmm. Floodplains.
Floodplains and
wetlands.
Mm-hmm. So that was the rural cluster that was just approved recently. Just to kind of show you how it goes from that, and then this is what was actually approved.
And this is one where VDOT did grant the waiver on the 2 entrance requirement.
Yeah. You said it's at the back of Sycamore Square?
What's that?
That's
behind
CVS, right?
Yes, at the very back of Justin Drive.
It's gotta be, it can't be the piece of land that's the 75% for Sycamore Square, correct?
It has to be open space.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
It has to be,
it must be
a lot.
Permanent open space.
Yes. So this is just the map of the rural cluster subdivisions, and I know it's a little small, and I have a next screen that kind of has more of a data-driven, but you can see, you know, we've got Rosewood Manor down here off of Route 6. You have a couple, Mountain Hill, which was approved not too long ago. Fluvanna Luisa Housing is doing that one. You got High Mountain Acres. You know, there's probably a lot of them that you're familiar with that are right around Lake Monticello, Cunningham Meadows, Houchins Place, Island Hill, which was probably the most recent one besides some of these that were recently approved. That's right next to Broken Island. You know, you got Panorama and High Point off of Miles Jackson, and then a few others. But this chart really here shows going back, you know, so the gray down below are rural cluster subdivisions that were either not approved, withdrawn, or they were withdrawn because, I'll give you, for example, Ballinger Bluff at the bottom, the SUP for a central water or central sewer system was denied. But all the ones up above in the white area, those are, you can see there's a column for cluster name, tax map, zoning, the location, total acreage, the year that it was approved, and then status, and then, you know, how many are proposed and how many are built out of that rural cluster subdivision.
These include the ones that were just put in?
Yeah, you can see Rivanna Bend right there towards the top. That one was just approved. Reventon Farm is the most recent one, too. That went to the Planning Commission. Again, that was the one that was deferred, and that'll be going back to the Planning Commission. So this is just kind of a list of what we have for rural clusters. And you can see over here, you know, how many were approved and how many have been built out of what was approved.
So Village Gardens was a rural cluster subdivision, right? I didn't.
So it originally went forward as a rezoning, and then once it didn't make the rezoning, it went forward as a rural cluster.
I count about 350 homes all together, something like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Over 20 years.
Yep.
So 17 homes per year.
And then, you know, so some cons that the board may consider. So one, rural cluster subdivisions are a by right use. So applications are presented to the Planning Commission for consideration. And again, they do not come before the board supervisors.
Again, rezoning is not required, therefore no proffers or development conditions are allowed. Again, I think something that the board could do if it was a rezoning, you could say what type of architectural features maybe you want of that particular development. You could proffer that, you know, trails are required as part of that thing. What are some other?
You know, have parks as part of it. You could also have, like, you know, brick to grade. You could have minimum square footage. You could also, you could have cash proffers towards schools and roads.
And again, rural cluster doesn't allow for that.
So many localities around here do that. I don't think we've ever done cash proffers to knowledge here.
And one thing with rural cluster, there is no acreage cap. So that, you know, that can lead to creation of large subdivision in rural areas of the county. You know, with interest rates being, you know, Fed just dropped interest rates 0.5% today. And, you know, that could potentially lead to a better interest rate environment. We know there's a housing shortage, but I guess my question is from the board, where do you want these subdivisions going that are by right? And with the rural cluster, the board doesn't have any say where those go. And one, road maintenance. So roads may not be built to VDOT standards. And so you want to talk about that?
So we have a number of subdivisions right now where, I'll give you just a couple of examples. Center Hill Estates, we've had, there are a couple of roads there which the residents would like to be taken into the system. The problem is VDOT's been not inspected them. And VDOT says they're not up to state standards. A lot of work is going to be required. Somebody's going to have to pay for that work to be done, presumably the homeowners. There are a number of other subdivisions that were built where the roads were constructed to VDOT standards. But for whatever reason, it was never taken into the system. And in time, the roads are deteriorated. Again, leads to an issue of work has to be done on them before VDOT will take them into the system. So in the meantime, property owners are on the hook for improvements and maintenance to those roads.
And then maintenance of open space. Again, a rural cluster is required to have an HOA, which would manage the open space. Residential lot sizes are sometimes small, and that open space is used for the water and sewer. And again, there's no amenities required for open space, trails, play areas, ball fields. Do you want a swimming pool or anything like that? So those are just some cons that we see as being there for the rural cluster. And Dan, you want to hit on some of the surrounding localities?
Sure. So we looked at the surrounding localities, and Albemarle County does not allow rural clusters. They allow rural preservation developments, which basically allow five or fewer lots of less than 21 acres, and no more than 20 lots that are lots of 21 or more acres. And so then also, if you look at the next one.
Yeah,
Louisa. We go to Louisa. So previously, Louisa allowed rural clusters. They no longer allow them there. Basically, in their A2 district, they allow 7 lots per parent parcel. And you can have 3 additional lots. If you have affordable housing, you basically get a density bonus for those 3 additional lots. You look at Goochland. They allow cluster developments in their residential preservation district. It requires a minimum lot size of 2 acres. One of the issues we don't have a lot size, so it could be a third of an acre, it could be half an acre. And if you look at Hanover, they require minimum parcel 20 acres, 1 lot per 10 acre density, and a max residential lot area 2 acres, and then 80% should be a conservation. But obviously, Hanover is a much faster growing locality than here. I think they have 100,000 people now, probably over 100,000. Cumberland County actually had almost identical language to ours. So either we copied their language or they copied ours. So the same thing, basically they allowed an A2, 1 dwelling for 2 acres, and then conservation lots 75%. So it looks like it's something the board adopted in the early 2000s when it was optional. And then basically when it was made mandatory, we already had the language, and just 2020 when we could have opted out of the program. I didn't at the time. So it's just an option.
So I'm sorry. You said when the board approved it was optional?
Correct. back in 2005, 2004, 2005 timeframe.
You weren't going back to 10% back then?
Nope. Nope. But also that language didn't come into effect until 2006. So, as I said, I think Mr. Fortune said you talked to someone on the Planning Commission and it was this, was Ms. Rittenhouse you talked to?
It was. So, it was a very brief conversation, but as she recalled, the rural clusters were basically a compromise to try and find a balance between those who were fine with the one dwelling unit for 2 acres in A1 and those who wanted to change it and wanted less density, one per 10 acres. So she said the commission went back and forth at the time, and then the rural clusters were just a compromise to find a middle ground on this issue.
In general, though, from a planning perspective, good overview type planning perspective, is it not better to have the properties clusters even though there was less traffic, if you would? I mean, it's pretty, bus routes and all those kinds of things are kind of minimized when you don't want to spread across the whole property. Well, that's the idea.
Well, I mean, yes and no. You are preserving open space, but at the same time, I'll give you the Revention as a perfect example. That one's proposing 67 dwelling units, pretty much on the edge of the county. There's going to be roads need to require them. There's a question of whether the public roads in place can handle the traffic that will be generated. And of course, there's also the issue that the increased population is going to place additional burden on public services. So,
you have 67 well and septic fields.
That's
another thing. They're close together.
Yeah, that's site of the special use permits. Does that have different options than the special wells?
That is an option. You can have a central water system, central sewer system. And that requires an SUP that would come to the.
That would have to go to the board. But if by chance they want to do just single well and septic fields and they can get it to work for VDH, then. And that's allowed them to burn. Yeah.
Well, to Tony's question, wouldn't it, by grouping them together, then create traffic choke points where these roads go on to the existing road system rather than 2 acre parcels spread out? So I come out onto the highway with my own parcel, Mike comes out on his, and now we're in a rural cluster. And I'll give you an example where I live. There's two choke points. And it worked for the Lakes Main Gate because they asked for turn lanes and did make it better. But that is a cluster point when people are trying to come in and out during rush hours.
Well, yeah, yes and no. I mean, your theory, you're not going to have all of your acre lots running right alongside the road and all the lots going to the choke points.
No, but for 200 houses, there's two ways to get on Lake Montchill Road, two and only two.
Right.
That's what cluster subdivisions do.
Yeah.
No, I understand that, but I guess, to me, the bigger point is, sure, we've got two that have just come up, but even with all of that, in the course of 20 years, we've had an average of 20 homes built per year, if you want to put it down to, cluster that occurred through cluster subdivisions probably exceeds the number of homes that we have approved through zoning changes in the last period of time. So, if you're trying to, ease housing prices and ease costs and things like that, the more restrictions you put on it, the more likely it is that those restrictions still work out for you. I'm of the opinion that taking away a right of a landowner is always a negative. I see the pluses of, potentially doing things like, being able to maintain the road, but I also kind of look at that as like, isn't that really the responsibility of the buyer coming into it and also the responsibility of the developer? When you're not doing that, you're not managing that, and, having it there.
Now, one thing is with the new road clusters, we are not requiring a bond. Mm-hmm. To make sure they're brought up to VDOT standards. What happened before is either the bonds were released, or they didn't put the resolution before the board to accept them into the VDOT system. So that's one thing with the new ones that are coming through. We're going to make sure there's a bond in place that adequately covers all road construction.
Might not be a bad idea to reach out to some of our colleagues in neighboring counties that have changed and gone to do something different to find out if it's working, if it's being successful. Would be my thought.
Could we refer this to the Planning Commission for review?
Yeah.
I think that's the appropriate place. Let them have first whack at it.
Well, but I'm still saying, we talked about Alamo's done away with them. Louise has done away with them. Goochland has done away with them. Is that what you said?
They only allow them in one,
one
district.
Area.
And it's pretty restrictive. Wow.
2 acres. Oh,
yeah. Wow.
I mean,
it's a little bit different than our
group. If they like the results that they're getting from making these changes, that probably would be something that we would look at.
I think a lot of the things that we want to understand in that process, too, as well as, you know, granted, the natures of boards change, but, you know, one could have argued that, for example, all the reason got away with it, got, you know,
went away
from it, moved away from it. They have been pretty aggressive in the approval of larger housing, you know, units that, from that standpoint. So, you know, logic of the thinking might be a little different.
I think if you talk, like, for instance, in Goochland, like, there's a one in the village of Goochland called Swan's End Estates. And there, the cash proffer was $19,000 per unit. So there's 30, 40 houses there, and that all that money is going to the schools. So that's one advantage of the rezoning process, is it's a voluntary proffer, but that's money that you get to, and you're not getting that as part of it.
I believe in the property rights as much as anybody. I also know that the impact on the schools and the rest of the county can be notable. And so when somebody sells, let's just say didn't proffer, then the rest of the taxpayers are covering the cost of the children going to school and so on. It's not all about that property owner or that developer to practice their rights. We also, as their neighbors, are going to participate in some of the expense.
And honestly, at this point, about Goochland, where they allow this, they have public water.
I was about to say,
yeah.
Public
water and sewer.
Probably one of the bigger.
That means without public water and sewer, that's what scares me to death, is you drop 67 wells, and all of a sudden people's wells start going dry. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, they got to come in and dig a new well, they got to go 500 feet deep or 400 feet deep.
But I mean, we saw that in when they were trying to do the golf course.
Up here,
yeah. But at the end of the day, they got to do the studies, they got to look at it. If they can't do it, then that's what the market was there. You know, to some degree, you know, you can sit there and analyze, you know, we do this, and which is why we oftentimes turn down, you know, subdivisions that are being proposed, because we nitpick away in terms of saying, well, that's going to be too many cars there, that's going to be too much of that. You know, what we proposed at Radovan Farms before was going to be more cars than the 67 homes that are. Okay, there's an impact one way or another, but you can look at it and simply say, you know, if you look at total growth in Atlanta County over the last decade, it's at 6%, and, you know, that if you look at the total amount of homes that have put in, you have more coming in through cluster subdivisions and by right uses than we do by any board actions that are happening. So,
I
think it's a tricky balance.
Well, and that's a little bit of my concern is if they're not going through the other way, are you going to see this big shift of things, maybe a lot of homes going in and maybe areas you don't want
to
go.
Not to mention, if everybody else around us has restricted it, where the developer is going to start looking to do it, and that's going to be right around here.
I would agree with what would be involved with sending it to the Planning Commission?
So basically, you just refer to
it.
It would just be a motion to refer to
the about the money transfer earlier. I mean, that's.
I don't want to hear this one. Can y'all just ask a question?
Yeah.
So it would kind of be like a solar. It would just be a motion to refer to the Planning Commission for consideration. And it would, the Planning Commission could consider it at their October meeting. If there's not going to be any changes to the ordinance, you'd have the Planning Commission or the board would have to first adopt the resolution to amend the code. And then you would have your public hearing for the
I
from. You say you ought to have concerns with it?
Yeah, with cluster subdivisions. I'm afraid of what they can lead to, and then putting the houses where we don't want houses.
We don't want houses, period. I don't think I'm very happy.
Tony's on the right hand, but my wife wouldn't be very happy.
I have a question for Mr. Fortune. So when we refer this down, could we also refer a second matter related to it down? So should we keep it? Can we have them look at the sketch plan, the yield plan versus the site plan to make sure that they're siding the lots on internal roads, not on existing external roads? That was raised in a recent TRC meeting.
That would be a ordinance change. The planning commission doesn't look at the site plans for that.
Just the sketch plan.
What I'm saying is the ordinance has, it's vague. It doesn't specify where the lots face onto.
All right, let me ask you a question. You're saying make sure it goes onto their roads, not onto the main
onto
road?
The internal roads.
But that what you just said you ended up having a problem with the two choke points?
4,500 homes around the lake, and we've got five choke points.
Yeah, it's not related to that.
Oh, time I will say right now, I'm still scared to death every time I turn around across.
Are you aware of what I'm talking about? In the most recent TRC, there was a question the way the lots were set up, and there were lots that faced onto an existing roadway.
I think I see what you're talking about. The yield plan for the Revenge subdivision. Yes, there were some lots that were fronting Briary Creek, I believe it was.
Yes. But not on the sketch plan, but on the yield
plan. No, it's just the yield plan, not on the sketch plan. So
if it's Briary Creek, then that's not going to be a huge issue because that's bringing them out where they're going to have to.
What I'm saying is if we're looking at keeping this as an option, so the planning commission, you've got to look at two pieces. Do we get rid of it or do we keep it? Mm-hmm. If we keep it, we should fix that flaw, the wording flaw in our ordinance, to make it clear how the lot should be sited on your yield plan.
Mm-hmm. I still think I would still go to public hearing, right? Because of the
ordinance
change.
Yes,
it would require an ordinance change. Language.
You can solve that problem by giving yourself an oversight and SUP process.
So
if we get rid of it, it's not an issue.
Correct. The one thing we have to look at is if you look at the state code, it says the implementation and approval of the cluster development and open space shall be done administratively by the locality staff without a public hearing. So we can't go too far. The planning commission really is only accepting it. They can't really dictate this is how it works. It's really staff's duty how, looking at the preliminary plan, how it's set up.
It's just and I know Mr. Fairchild was at that public hearing, but that was one of the first subdivisions, public hearings that I've been a part of, and it's really, I guess it's not public hearing, it's an action matter, or is it a public hearing? And it's not, because really the citizens have really no say over what's kind of going on there, and then really the planning commission, I almost had to ask myself, I guess there's some sort of process or legal code that says it has to go before the planning commission, but it's almost like a waste of time, and the only reason that one was deferred and could be deferred was, I think there was a question to Mr. Witten about
some VDOT.
About VDOT issue, and it was just kind of like, and my thing was like, okay, well, what if you don't, if they get what they get from VDOT, and you still kind of don't really, you still have issues with it, it really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
That's why most localities, their planning commissions don't consider sketch plans. It's kind of rare that we do. Actually, I think, I heard recently Mr. Payne actually had recommended that planning commission no longer accept sketch plans. About a couple years ago, he made that recommendation to the planning department.
Aside from growth, whatever your philosophy is on that, to me, when I look at cluster subdivisions, say Two Rivers or something like that, I like the fact that instead of taking 60 acres and whether you're putting, one home on 5 acres or one home on 10 acres, is the fact that you're preserving 75% of the land. That you are concentrating the rest in a particular area, which I think also can add to sort of value of community. It does reduce the cost of services. So, I was always very impressed with Two Rivers in terms of how that works. And, there are other cluster subdivisions that are smaller, there are some that are bigger, but, to me, that's, it seems like it's worked pretty well, and it isn't creating some enormous crisis in the world.
But
But could it?
Tomorrow the world could fall off. Yes, it could.
Yes, it could. But I think looking back and saying, well, it hasn't been this is kind of being predictive about what could be down the road. And I understand what you're saying. I mean, the numbers do show that it hasn't been a huge issue, but it doesn't mean that it couldn't be.
Well, 2005, 2007, those were high growth years. We just went through high growth years here. That's just kind of the nature of it is, do you have a willing person who wants to settle by the land or settle to do this thing? Are they going to put the money into it? Again, Two Rivers, just to give you an example, they put the road in, they put the utilities in, and I think that place sat without any homes on it for almost 8 or 9 years. There's no guarantee that when you do this, it's still a huge investment in that that you're putting in that you're going to make that happen.
I don't think this is the place to debate the pros and cons. It does it go to the planning commission?
I'm not going to ask you to make a motion, is it? Did you mention that?
Yeah, I'll make a motion that we refer this to planning commission for review and recommendation back to the board of supervisors by the second meeting in November.
Thank you.
Discussion, real quick. What does that say for applications that are currently in the hopper?
They can proceed. I mean, the applications can proceed until the ordinance is in place.
Okay.
So because it's a by right use.
So if the ordinances, let's say we pass this before those pass, they're not grandfathered?
Yeah, the ones that are already approved have vested rights, and they're grandfathered.
Okay.
So Verbenton Farms, if that is accepted, planning commission meeting, it will have vested rights, it will move, So if any applications come in between now and between the ordinance change and they go through the planning commission and they're accepted, they have vested rights.
And specifically, what we're remanding is for them to just take a look and look at essentially whether we remove this by right use. And I'm assuming that the next step would be by special use permit, correct?
Well, I mean, you'd go through the normal rezoning process.
You would do the rezoning.
Yeah.
You could send it to R3 or R4.
You can't do R4 because we public utilities, right? So.
Well, you said previously that they tend to go where there's public.
No, I said that's kind of differential. Is the reason you have a cluster is they don't have the full public utilities, whereas the R4.
So it would be a rezoning, but likely not a special use permit.
Correct.
Yeah. All right.
Good. Your questions?
Yep. Thank you.
Sorry. Who made the motion?
Second.
Mr. Hodge made the motion. Second by Mr. Sheridan. All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody against? I'm sure I watched the list.
I don't have any problem
with
that.
Okay, chair votes aye, 5-0. Moving on to.
Was there any other new business?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Tim, did you have something like this?
We briefly covered the budget season. I just have one request.
Yep.
When we do the nonprofits,
yep.
Can we ask them to complete that entire form and to also give us their two previous years' financials as part of the packet rather than having to fish around, look for whatever. If they're unsure what a good submission looks like, tell them to look at Flu Vanna Louisa Housing Federation. That was a really good one last year.
Foundation.
Yes.
So the form plus 2 years' financials.
Yep. A lot of times, some of them would fill them in, and they would either leave blocks blank or put something, what happens if this is not funded? It's not funded. That's where you're supposed to tell me the world's going to end and all the bad things. So I don't know what impact it'll have.
I agree with that.
It'd be interesting to see what surrounding look at, but you could make up a list of things that you could ask to want these people for. But I know sometimes you have to go fishing, like, well, what did Louisa do here? I know we don't have to model everything on after that, but it would be nice to know what maybe some surrounding localities have, what they have were given the year before by the localities. I would say probably Louisa,
Albemarle, Shoals,
Albemarle,
Green.
Green.
Mm-hmm. That would be helpful.
Anything else? All right, we're going to move on to the second round of public comment.
Anybody wishing to address the board, please come to the podium, state your name and address, and please remember to keep your comments in 5 minutes on topic matter and direct it to the board.
Come on, Andy, come on up.
Did you have some, Tony? I think you're 3 for 3 on the last second. You have a comment or whatever.
All right, seeing nobody wishing to speak, we'll close a second round of the public comments.
Mr. Chair, I move the Platte County Board of Supervisors to enter into closed meetings with the provisions of Section 2.2-3711A. The purposes of discussing legal matters, land property, water, sewer construction project, contract user grants, cluster, and water and sewer ordinance.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Good, all in favor?
Aye.
Chairman votes aye, 5-0.
Mr. Chair, I move to close meeting the adjournment to Platte County Board of Supervisors. Convene again in open session. Be it resolved, the Board of Supervisors does hereby certify to the best of each member's knowledge that one, only public business matters lawfully exempt from open meeting requirements in our Section 2.2-3711A of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended, and two, only such public business matters as were identified in the motion by which the closed meeting was convened were heard, discussed, or considered in the meeting.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Goad. Mr. O'Brien?
Aye.
Mr. Goad?
Aye.
Mr. Hodge?
Aye.
Mr. Sheridan?
Aye.
Chair votes aye, passes 5-0.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Sheridan, seconded by Mr. Hodge, all in favor?
Aye.
Good night, Mr. O'Brien.
Aye.
Chair votes aye, 5-0.